This podcast is brought to you by Viva Global. Experience the difference with Viva. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
The J Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J Talk Podcast. I'm Ben Maxwell. On this week's episode, Sam Robson and Ryan Steele join me to run through all of the results from J1 Match Day 14, the last round before the international break. Before we get going, though, watch your podcast feeds on Wednesday afternoon, Japan time, as the first episode of J-Talk Extra Time will be dropping after Stuart and John record it on Tuesday night. And thanks for all the positive feedback after our big announcement last week. Clearly, a lot of you are as excited as we are to have a dedicated J2 pod on its way. All right, Sam and Ryan are waiting, so let's get going. The J-Talk podcast starts now. As promised, I'm joined by Sam Robson and Ryan Steele to chat about all the goings-on in J1 over the weekend. Firstly, Sam, welcome back to the pod. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm terrific, thank you very much. And Ryan, a big welcome back to you as well. How are things?
It's great to be back, Ben. Things are not too bad, I suppose, all things considered with Arawa. Thanks for asking.
You are more than welcome. And it's, yeah, great to have you on in, well, it's always great to have you on, Ryan. But, yeah, Reds certainly in the news in the past week with the sacking of Osvaldo Oliveira. Of course, in the aftermath of that 4-0 battering at the hands of Hiroshima in the previous match day, we'll come on to all the behind-the-scenes goings-on at Reds when we talk about their clash with the Kawasaki that took place on Saturday night. That's the second game in our rundown. The first is leaders FC Tokyo going back 6 points clear at the top of the table at the international break. That is thanks to, well, in a large part, it's due to Reds at Todoroki, which we're going to come on to. But, yeah, Tokyo went 7 points clear in the live table with a 3-1 home win over Oita on Saturday afternoon at Ajinomoto Stadium. Again, a somewhat frustratingly low crowd of just over 25,000 saw it, Sam, but well, it's going to end up being a shame. A lot of Tokyo supporters will wish they were there because they might have missed, the ones that didn't turn up, they might have missed Takefusa Kubo's last game for the club. And correct me if I'm wrong, I reckon it was also his best.
Yeah, I was very surprised at the attendance figures. I thought it would be fairly well known that this had a good chance of being Kubo's last game, so I expected a good send-off for him. He certainly delivered, definitely his best performance of the season. He was involved in absolutely everything. Part of the first goal, laying it back to Maroya, then he got his two goals as well. A bit of help for the third goal by some pretty woeful back passing from Titipan, but otherwise he was involved in absolutely everything. So confident in possession, like the drop of the shoulder, the little bit of burst of speed to get past defenders. He was absolutely terrific. I mean, last season I thought, obviously he was very younger, as he still is, but he was still needed to kind of build a bit of strength to his game and get a bit more confidence. But this season, I don't know what Hasegawa's done over the break or if it's just Kubo working himself, but he has been superb and he's got better and better. And this was like the perfect performance to perhaps end his J-League career for now.
Well, yeah, Sam, a lot of Tokyo supporters don't know that it might have been Kubo's last game. A, because they've probably got their heads in the sand, and B, also, the club have not obviously released any information about his contract status and the fact that, yes, there is a genuine possibility that he could leave the club in this international break. I mean, there's some speculation that the contract that he was playing on at the start of the season only ran until the end of May, and he might have even just signed a one-day extension to play on Saturday against Oita. So, for all intents and purposes, he appears to be a free agent at this point in time, and, well, obviously that means he could go anywhere he wants. But, Tokyo want to try and keep hold of him, but I even though they haven't admitted it, they must surely know that's a forlorn hope at this stage. But yes, as you say, Kubo was electric. And, well, in the second minute, he almost had an assist with Diego Oliveira seeing a shot saved at point-blank range by the Oita keeper, Shun Takagi. But then right up the other end, 2 minutes later, Ado Onaiwu set up Yuji Hoshi from point-blank range. But Akihiro Hayashi saved with his legs. So there could have been a goal at either end in the first 5 minutes. But as it was, we had to wait until the half-hour mark. And as Sam mentioned briefly, Kubo was involved. He drew two defenders down the right, played a simple ball back to see Muroya, who was in acres of space as his man had gone to try and hunt down Kubo. Muroya floated in a decent enough cross into the centre, and Kento Hashimoto headed it home. And not from there, because it had already been the Kubo show, but Kubo took the headlines again in the 39th minute. He fired home via a deflection at Takagi's near post after taking possession about 45, 50 yards out from goal and dribbling into the box. Ryan, I don't know how much you've seen of Kubo this season, but as Sam and I both said, this was without question his best performance. I guess it's another one of those where a young player, a quality young player, is has had his head turned. Well, we know that Kubo was playing in Spain when he was 10 years old, so I guess he's not quite the same case as some of the others in recent years. But, another one gone too soon, I guess. And for me personally, as a Tokyo supporter, it's obviously going to be a massive loss to us.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's been an incredible player for FC Tokyo, but also just in terms of having him in the league, it just, you know, it puts another Japanese star player that can bring attention to the league. You know, there's highlights going literally around the world, being shared on Twitter and other social media of his goals that he's already scored this season, and just some of the performances when he was on loan at Yokohama F Marinos. Sorry, and you know, for him to have all this attention from Barcelona and apparently also Paris Saint-Germain as well, it's not a surprise. It would be I suppose a bit of a disappointment for him to leave the league. A bit of a disappointment for the J League at least. Probably not for him and his development. If he goes somewhere where he can get a great opportunity, then you know he should take that, because he's got the potential to go really far. And you know, this performance was a huge thing for his highlight reel. That's really going to continue this upwards rise of his name, especially if he goes overseas from here. You know, to leave on a high like that would be outstanding for him, really.
Yeah, and Sam, well, I've got to hold my hands up, because earlier on in the season, I kind of laughed off the possibility that Kubo leaving might scuttle any title hopes that FC Tokyo had in 2019. Well, firstly, because I didn't believe that an FC Tokyo title push was realistic. But, I mean, here we are 14 games into the season and Tokyo are 6 points clear. And by the way, six, what a magical number that is, six times. But the simple fact is that if Kubo was going to run games like he did on Saturday afternoon, then taking him out of the team, okay, it's the most obvious thing I've ever said on this podcast, it's going to leave a massive void in the team, and there simply isn't another player in the Tokyo squad with that level of ability, that creativity that he has, and the even, you know, at 17 years and however many days old he is, or as he ticks over to 18 years old, I mean, there is no player in the Tokyo squad that J-League defenders fear as much as him. Diego Oliveira is probably on a similar level, but I mean, Kubo, what he's done this season and the development he's shown in the past 3 months is simply phenomenal. And while all Tokyo supporters will wish him the best, you know, we were hoping that there was a chance that he might move to a different club but get loaned back, but I mean, it's hard to see that eventuating now, as he really looks to you know, kick his career on. He's not waiting around, even though he's only 18 years old. So you know, I mean, I've been pessimistic about Tokyo's title hopes all season, but taking him out is Tokyo's going to have to do some business in the transfer window when it opens. I mean, there's no question about that, is there?
Yeah, it's going to be a huge loss, especially given the last maybe five or six games where he has really come to the fore and added goals to his game as well. When at a time where Diego Oliveira has not scored, he's gone five games himself without a league goal. So if you have Diego not in form and Kubo not there, then it's really it's going to look difficult for Tokyo. It's a similar situation to where they were last season, where they were up at the top, then Diego ran out of form, and then no one else really stepped up. So yeah, Tokyo are going to have to invest in the summer, try and bring someone in. I know there were the rumours of Arjen Robben maybe in January that those started. Maybe that's an option, although he's been injured forever. But they're going to have to bring in someone, because like the likes of Nasunko and Kataro Omori, no disrespect to them, but they're not quite at the same level that Kubo is, and you can't expect the same consistency of performance from them. So it's going to be really interesting to see what Tokyo do in this summer, because they have to build on the team and have to try and maintain a title push. Because if they drop off again as they did last season, I mean, it doesn't look good either on the team or on Hasegawa in terms of keeping up that momentum. So yeah, it's going to be an interesting couple of weeks for Tokyo to see, first of all, what happens with Kubo. Ideally, he does come back on loan for Tokyo's sake, but I don't see that happening. So then it depends on where Tokyo go from there.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about names from right field, Ryan. I mean, yeah, Robben has been rumored in recent months. Obviously, Kenta Hasegawa has a relationship with Takashi Usami, who has said that he wants to leave Germany and come back to, well, it's been reported that he said he wants to come back to Gamba. If he simply wants to come back to the J-League and is open to offers, then I don't know if Hasegawa could have a word in his ear. I don't know, Takashi Usami in an FC Tokyo shirt taking the spot of Takefusa Kubo doesn't sound like a too shabby a replacement to me.
No, not at all. I mean, definitely for the namesake and bringing or maintaining, I suppose, interest in the team and the league, it's definitely a name that they could count on for that. And you know, as you said, the relationship he has with Kenta Hasegawa is definitely important in terms of them trying to attract him to the club. The question would be if he does want to come back, then you know, are Gamba interested? And I mean, it'd be hard for them to say no anyway. But you know, I think FC Tokyo would be in a good position if they do end up selling Kubo. Then you know, they're probably in a good position to really be aggressive about trying to sign a new player. And yeah, you're absolutely right. Usami would be a good addition to the team, a good replacement for Kubo. It's there would be an adjustment period, just as there would be with any other player. But I think having that familiarity, if I can get my words out, with the league and the opponents that he'd be facing would play a huge be a huge benefit to him. You know, being a new face in the FC Tokyo team. More so than someone like Arjen Robben would, which, you know, I think that's just a pipe dream that's kind of come along from the whole Vissel Kobe sort of thing. You know, just throwing around as many big names as possible and doing what you can to I suppose, fancy up the league.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, the FC Tokyo front office have never really pushed the boat out. And whether it's a big domestic name like Usami or even Shinji Okazaki, who would obviously not be a direct replacement for Kubo, but could be a possible arrival in the summer transfer window, then we'll have to wait and see whether an international name comes in. But surely, I mean, this, as we've said so many times this season, this is uncharted territory for Tokyo at the top of the table. They will, and again, another obvious statement, they'll never get a better chance to win the J1 title than being 6 points clear after 14 games. So, yes, they've got to get their their backside's in gear, and they've got to get a couple of players in the summer, regardless of if Kubo goes or not, I would suggest. But that does appear a foregone conclusion. Anyway, guys, we're only 2 goals into this game. We're only reaching the first goal from Kubo in the 39th minute. Well, Ado Onaiwu, the previously mentioned Oita striker, made it 2-1 and made it interesting just before the hour mark with an excellent left-footed finish across Akihiro Hayashi. But as Sam's mentioned briefly, Kubo did have a bit of help for his second goal in the 91st minute with a very poorly hit back pass from Titipan, basically going nowhere, and with Takagi out of his box. Kubo raced clear and rolled into an empty net from 35 yards, and that was it. So, Kubo's third and fourth league goals of the season. 3-1 home win for Tokyo. And as I said, that took them 7 points clear in the live table. They finished the match day 6 ahead of Kawasaki and Yokohama F. Marinos. Before we leave this game, ever so briefly, though, Sam, are we seeing the Oita bubble start to burst? That is back-to-back losses, and they've not won in 3 now. Obviously, going away to the league leaders was always going to be a difficult ask for them, and they're absolutely loving life, still 6th in the table after 14 games. But I don't know, are we slightly seeing the bubble bursting here?
Potentially. There's been a few more errors creeping into their game. They're always going to have risks when they play with Takagi operating kind of outside of his area and then trying to build up from the back. And at the start of the season, that was working perfectly. But the last couple of weeks, a few errors have creeped in. They've started to lose games. And now they've got the next 4 games are really difficult. Then Nagoya, Kobe, Reds and Yokohama. It's a horrible run of fixtures. And they could find themselves back in mid-table by the end of those. The only good thing is they've got this kind of international break where they can sort of regroup. But they are losing. Iwata is off to the Copa America with the Japan national team. And a team like Oita can't really afford to lose key players in that manner. So it's going to be interesting to see how they cope with that loss and how they kind of regroup after a pretty testing couple of weeks.
All right. And Ryan, I better let you have a chance to chat about Oita if you like. What have you made of their Cinderella rise up the table? Well, not up the table. They were nowhere in J1 last year, of course, were they? But the way they've hung around. I mean, they've dropped a couple of spots to 6th here. But yeah, basically, they've been inside the top 6 the entire season so far. And, a lot of guests have had a lot of great things to say about them so far this season. How much have you caught of them, and how much have you thought it's been real as it's been going along? And do you wonder if now this is a kind of a regression to the mean on its way?
Those are all great questions. I think when they first they started in the first division this year, they probably were just hoping or expecting to survive relegation at best. So to have started the way that they have, getting some really good wins with some really good performances under their belt in the first handful of games, it would have been an absolute dream for the fans. I think as the season's kind of gone on a little bit longer, the coaching staff have kind of thought, okay, how do we sustain this, or how do we make sure that we don't drop too hard too fast? And they've done, I still think, a reasonable job. I mean, this was a loss to, if you can even still believe it yourself, top of the league team. So it's not anything to be too hard on yourself about. I think some of the players that they have would be good enough to be in most or any other team in the league. Some of the performances from Ado and Iwu have been actually really good. You see highlights. You can see the impact he has on their attack, and even in this game, he was quite influential. Arguably, should have had an assist early in the first half as well. I don't think that they're going to have too hard a fall. I think the coaching staff are fairly well prepared. They're probably learning the lesson from trying to move things on really quickly like they did in this match. you know, the I also kind of think that you know, the players want to bounce back as well, and that's going to be a really important factor in this team kind of continuing moving forward for the rest of the season. I'd probably say that they can at least manage a kind of mid-table finish at this point. It's, you know, as we've said throughout most of the season so far, it's still early days, so there's a lot to learn for most of this team that haven't really experienced top flight football or much top flight football. So yeah, it's regardless going to be a great season for them. I think there's going to be a lot to look back on and you know, realize that they can push forward in the next season as well.
No question. All right. Well, and I said they dropped the two spots to six, but yeah, I mean, they're still level on points with the fourth place Nagoya and indeed Kashima in fifth. They're trailing both of those teams on a goal difference. So it's been an unquestioned success of a season so far for Trinita. And yeah, as Sam said, some tricky fixtures on the horizon after Saturday's in the rearview mirror. Trinita have shown enough this season to suggest that, yes, they'll be plucky underdogs and they'll be, capable of pulling off more wins as the season progresses. All right, well, let's turn our attentions to Todoroki on Saturday night. Or before we do, though, Ryan, of course, let's address the sacking of Osvaldo Oliveira and Tsuyoshi Otsuki taking charge in the Saitama Stadium dugout, although he was in the Todoroki dugout, of course, away on Saturday night. How did you feel when the news came through? Did you feel it was inevitable after that 4-0 hammering at the hands of Hiroshima, or after the qualification for the ACL round of 16, did you feel that Oliveira might have been given his chance to take the club as far as he could in that competition?
I think it was kind of inevitable before the 4-0 loss to Sanfrecce. I think that it's kind of been just being dragged out for a while. You know, the occasional good performance or the wins in the Champions League that they've had has kind of helped Oliveira be given some breathing room from the pressure. But the 4-0 was absolutely the straw that broke the camel's back. It's kind of a long time coming. I thought maybe before that game, they might give him, you know, until kind of midway through the season, give him a bit more time to kind of see if he could turn things around, at least in the league, since he's through to he took the team through to the round of 16, albeit by, you know, leaving it to the very last game. I'm not convinced that it should have been left as long as it should have, to be on, as long as it was, to be honest. I kind of think that there are a few games. I mean, they hadn't won. They lost four consecutive games after that 4-0. So, you know, four consecutive league games, I should say. And that was, you know, that was just building up frustration with the fans, building up frustration with, I'm sure, the players and even some of the other coaching staff. There were rumors, and I'm not sure how true these are, but they were in some media outlets were saying that Oliveira was feeling, I suppose, threatened by the influence that Otsuki had on the playing staff, and had pushed him kind of to the outer of the team, try to give him as little influence as possible, so that he could, you know, have his control of the squad and keep Otsuki at kind of arm's length from everyone. So there was a lot of tension in the backroom staff as well, and I'm sure that played a huge part in what's culminated, and also in the playing performances as well. It would have had a serious effect. So to sum up that long-winded answer, I think it was coming for a while, but yeah, the 4-0 was definitely what did it for him.
All right, and with the ACL qualification secured and the round of 16 not taking place for a while, then, yeah, obviously they've they had time to make that change. So, yeah, regardless of the the ACL qualification or not, then they were going to wait and see what happened at the end of the group stage before making that call. I mean, that makes sense. So I hadn't thought of it in that way, but that, it does make a lot of sense. Sam, obviously Oliveira is one of the most successful managers in J-League history. And when he replaced Tsuyoshi Otsuki at the end of April last year, of course, Otsuki came in on a temporary basis after Takafumi Hori was sacked. We wondered what the Brazilian magician would do at Urawa. And frankly, I was fairly fearful of what he might do with Reds' powerful squad, a squad full of big names. It turns out that he wasn't able to do a great deal. And we wondered so much throughout this season with them being so sluggish and so slow to get going, if they ever would, click into gear. And as it's turned out, Oliveira's time's run out before we've ever really seen his side click into any sort of form this year.
Yeah, it's been a really disappointing spell for him. I thought last year he came in, did okay. They won the Emperor's Cup, so I thought they're going to build on that. They made some, on paper, really good signings in, like, Yamanaka, Sugimoto. Everton came in and looked a decent midfielder. But, yeah, that was sluggish from the start. We've all talked about the lack of pre-season preparation, just that one friendly, which doesn't seem to have worked. And when they have won, it's been, like, just kind of scraping victories, but then when they've lost, it's the manner of the defeat. Sanfrecce was just the latest one. They lost to Sapporo at the start of the season when they were beaten 2-0, but it was so comfortable for Sapporo in that game. Then the game at home to Yokohama, where that was one of the worst performances I've ever seen from a Reds team, just absolutely torn apart by Yokohama. And like, even in the Champions League, they did get through, but the performances in general weren't very good, especially the game away at Beijing. They got a 0-0 draw out of that, but were just destroyed. Like, I think the shot count was something like 20-4. Maybe it was even worse than that. I mean, the win against Beijing in that final ACL game was kind of the exception to the rule. And yeah, it's just not worked out for him. Another problem he had is just he played the same team pretty much in every game, not making any changes. You could name 8 of the 11 without really thinking. And kind of that refusal to change things up, it didn't really help. The only game really where they looked positive, and it was the Shonan game where they made 11 changes, and you brought in a lot of hungry players. And for the first half an hour of that game, they were superb. But otherwise, it's just been quite stale, and I think it was the right decision to get rid of him.
Yeah, so 7 home league games this season under Oliveira. Only one of them was won. That was at 1-0 over Kobe. And one draw, of course, at Ryota Moriwaki, snatching a point for Reds at home against the FC Tokyo at the death, deep into stoppage time. And he segues nicely onto Saturday night. Moriwaki repeated the dose in the 95th minute this time. Ryan, well, I mean, things are going all right, aren't they? Because you've drawn with the top two in the table, and nobody else can say that this season. You've taken two points from games against FC Tokyo and Kawasaki. That's tremendous going, surely.
The results are good. I do think that result kind of puts some rose-tinted glasses on the performance, as there's a lot of things that need to be worked on. But I mean, you could say that for I suppose all of the wins that Urawa have had this year. So it doesn't really say much.
I tell you what though, Otsuki got them out. He sent them out with some sort of a mission, because the first half hour, from the highlights anyway, it was one way traffic. It was all Reds in the chances in the first half hour.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, the thing with Otsuki, he really wants aggressive football, and I think that was shown in the game. It was to have turned it around to show that sort of approach so soon in his in his interim tenure is a positive to show that he can build upon that. I mean, a lot of the players are already quite familiar with his playing style from last season. But yeah, there was a lot of questionable decisions. I think there's still lots of individuals that need some more attention, changes to their games. It was more individual mistakes than team mistakes, I think. And those are the things that I really think need to be worked on. But yeah, I mean, to get a draw in his first game, and how well he did, with the team when he had them for a few games last season as well. A lot of fans already calling for him to take over the team, just like they were last season as well. So, it'll be interesting to see, what happens, both with him, taking the team forward for at least the next few weeks or couple of months. And then, yeah, what happens with the future of the team, whether it stays like this, whether they make changes and stuff. But to see even a new direction, with the team, a new approach to how they're playing football was definitely a positive, because it's quite frankly a breath of fresh air from what we've been seeing for the last few months.
Yeah, I'll tell you what though, if he does get the job permanently, I certainly hope he sorts his hairstyle out, because it's damaging my eyes to look at that kind of slick back on the top, but shaved to the skull or on the side kind of look. That took a lot of getting used to on Saturday night, and certainly hope he's going to have that looked into. As I say, if he's going to stick around for much longer, he'll definitely need to get that sorted out. But Sam, well, yeah, as I said to Ryan, I thought from the highlights at least, Reds made a terrific start to this game, and whether that was a new manager bounce that only lasted for half an hour, I don't know. But, I mean, Tommy Ugajian swept in a terrific shot. He found the net in just the second minute. But Shinzo Kuroki was a hair offside in the centre, and the linesman decided that he was distracting Jung Sung Ryong enough to raise his flag and disallow the goal. Then Martinez fired in a shot in the fifth minute, Yuki Muto in the 16th, and then Martinez's header went to inches wide just past the half hour, and it was only after that that Kawasaki seemed to buck up their ideas and start to play some decent attacking stuff themselves.
Yeah, it was definitely a much better start from Reds than we've become accustomed to. There was definitely an energy to them. There were players that had got a first start or one of the few starts this season. They looked like they were trying to put on a performance to really show that, yeah, I'm still here as well. Like Martinez as well, he came in. He was like kind of the driving force for that first half an hour. He's not really had a look in ever since he joined from Yokohama. And at Yokohama, he could be a bit hit and miss, but that last season there, he was one of their better players, so he would really expect a bit more game time. So he tried to show what he could do. Ugajin came in on the left. I thought they're a little unlucky with that one, because Kuroki doesn't touch it, but maybe he is just close enough to be deemed interfering with play. But it was a case of they played well for that half now, maybe even the first half. But then second half, kind of Kawasaki took over. Kind of the quality did shine through for long periods in that second half. And Kawasaki will be very disappointed that they didn't come away with a victory. They had quite a few chances in that second half after taking the lead. But for Reds, just that positivity at the start, and then the manner in which they got the equaliser, that's going to give them so much confidence going forward. It's almost kind of the perfect way to end that first game, because Kawasaki away, toughest game that Otsuki could really have had, and they've come out with a lot of positivity and a lot of things that they can build on.
Most definitely. All right, so for Frontale, Tatsuya Hasegawa was very prominent. He had their first real chance of the game when he cut in from the left in the 33rd minute, and he was involved in the build-up to them taking the lead 9 minutes into the second half. He again cut in from the left, slid in Kyohei Noborisato, who's a ball across the box, found Leandro at the back post. So, with half an hour plus to go, Kawasaki looked to build on their lead, and there were chances again for Kobayashi and for Hidemasa Morita, and Akihiro Iyanaga will be having sleepless nights over his miss in the 92nd minute, which obviously would have iced the game for Frontale, but he fired wastefully wide, and that allowed Reds yes, to remain alive in the contest. And after Takuya Ogiwara's shot was deflected out for a corner, literally at the death in the 94th, 95th minute, Nishikawa came up for the corner. Ugajin scuffed his ball back into the box after it was if it was headed out. Nishikawa flicked it on, and after a bit of a pinball wizard, Moriwaki's shot deflected in off Shogo Taniguchi past a helpless Jung. So, yes, a point for Reds in Otsuki's first game back in charge of the club. And, I don't know, Ryan. So as we sit here after that taking that point and an international break, at, so 2 weeks for Otsuki to work on things, how are you feeling about, I don't know, a fresh start and maybe a more prominent role for, I don't know, the likes of Kai Shibato in central midfield? And as Sam said, Martinez was impressive here. He might he might feature more prominently in the matches to come.
The 2 week break is incredibly important after the performance to build on something and give them some time to kind of assess everything and also for Otsuki to really pick his team, find what's going to work for him, because he did change the way that they're playing as well. You know, they're playing with the back four now, and also as I mentioned before, the kind of mental approach as well, the mentality of the team, at least in attack, is much different to what Oliveira had. So that extra time that they're going to have ahead of the next run of games and, you know, the Champions League and everything else is going to be extremely beneficial to the team. The kind of, I suppose, fringe players that Osvaldo had, they're going to definitely get a better look in. I know that Martinez was absolutely not happy, to use the kindest of terms, about being omitted from the Champions League squad. He was not registered, and Fabrizio was, and Fabrizio, you know, he came back from injury in time for the last game of the group stage. So to have missed an entire group stage for a player that was only available for one game right at the end, you can understand why he was frustrated by that and not happy, and he was looking for a way out, really. So Ossie's going to have going to have a sit down with him and kind of work out what they're going to do and probably offer him some more game time, kind of make him feel more like he's at least important to the team. Because I'm sure he wasn't feeling that way leading up to Oliveira's dismissal, and to see some other players, Iwatake come on or to start, sorry, and other changes as well. Yamanaka was not in the starting 11, which you could almost say that he was the cause of Oliveira's dismissal in that game against Sanfrecce. So, Otsuki hasn't been afraid to make changes, and I'm sure we're going to see even more changes to come in the future.
All right, then. So it's a Tosu at home for Reds after the international break, then a trip to Oita, and then they host Sendai. So two of the current bottom three at home in their next three games. It offers a possibility for Otsuki's Reds to get a bit of confidence and some wins under their belt and some points on the board, etc., etc. Cliche alert. All right, so it was a frustrating ending to the game on Saturday night for Kawasaki, as they wasted their chance to go back 4 points behind FC Tokyo. But as it was, that point they earned at home against Reds, it took them back above their prefectural rivals Yokohama, who went second in the live table on Friday night with a 2-1 win in the Kanagawa Derby away at Shonan Bellmare. An assist and a goal here for Teruhito Nakagawa. Sam, he set up Edgar Jr. in the 12th minute. And then after Kosuke Takitomi had equalised at point-blank range for Bellmare a minute before half-time, Nakagawa scored just past the hour mark. So, I don't know, slightly putting you under the spot here, question without notice. If the J-League was putting together a team of the season after 14 match days, I reckon Nakagawa would have a pretty decent shout of being in it, wouldn't he?
Yeah, it's quite odd you said that, because I was just having this conversation a couple of days ago. He's been really, really good this season. His pace is just kind of so difficult for any defender to deal with, and especially in this game. Yeah, Shonan had a lot of players out, and they were forced to play Leleu at a left wing back, who's usually an attacking midfielder, and he got so caught out, especially first half, for the first goal, and maybe there was a chance just before the goal as well. And Leleu is kind of daydreaming, and Nakagawa is in behind, and once he's past you, you're not going to catch him. But then he's also developed more of an end product as well. At the end, he's able to find a pass when he gets into the just cutting into the box, and he's also got a goal about him as well. I think he's really come on, because maybe 2 years ago he went out on loan at Avispa in J2, really didn't do a lot there, and when he came back he was kind of given some confidence from Postecoglou. He put him into the team straight away. He's been a key player for Yokohama for the last couple of seasons, and yeah, he's really thriving at the moment, and now he's got the likes of Edgar Jr. and Marcus Jr. who he can feed off and who he can play in. I think there's a really good understanding between those three players in particular, and it's only going to be beneficial for Yokohama as they continue this kind of push towards at least an ACL spot, an outside chance of maybe even a push for the title.
Most definitely. Yeah, I mean, Nakagawa does tend to feature a lot on the highlights, most recently of Marcos Junior goals, because as I said on last week's show, those two definitely get in a lot of time at training, practicing their goal performances. And to be fair to the pair of them, they have had a lot of opportunities this season to test them out. But Nakagawa has been absolutely tremendous. And I don't know, he might be one of those players in a kind of a similar mould to Shoya Nakajima, Ryan, who, Nakajima never really got much of a chance at FC Tokyo, but when he finally got a manager to show a little bit of faith in him, he absolutely flourished, and now look where he is now. Well, I mean, he's playing in the Middle East, but I mean, he should be in one of the better leagues in Europe, but that was his made a life decision, in inverted commas, to make his wife and his dogs happy, so it's a fair play to Shoya, as I take a massive tangent there. But my point stands that Nakagawa has been waiting for an opportunity, and yeah, maybe a manager to show a little bit of faith in him, and Ange Postecoglou is now certainly reaping the rewards of the faith he's shown in Nakagawa.
Yeah, well, I think as we all know by now, anyone that follows the J-League or even I know there are a lot of Australian listeners, people that follow the A-League or the Socceroos or just Asian football in general, are familiar with Ange Postecoglou and what he brings to a football team. And, you know, players like that, Nakayama and, basically the whole team now, fit his style of play. And they're obviously reaping the rewards from it, but you know, they've got players. I think they've got two or three players in the top 10 of goal scorers at the moment. They've also got two or three in the top 10 of the assists as well. It's just incredible to see how well oiled that team have become after, you know, a bit of a stuttering start, which I suppose you would expect when it's such a dramatic change. But to see those players firing up front is just, it can be incredible to watch at times, the way they work together and they find each other behind the defence or in space, and they're able to play through with these real quick one or two touch combinations, and it's just amazing. So to see what these kinds of players can bring, as you mentioned Nakajima as well, that kind of player, you're right, it's very, very similar. I will pull you up. He is a cup winner as well, so he's got that to his name now. But going back to Yokohama, he's Nakagawa is just a great what's the word I'm looking for? I would almost say a benchmark for that kind of player. When you're looking for that kind of skillful player up front that can provide and also be the point of an attack as well. He's so good to watch.
Yeah, terrific stuff. No room in the starting lineup in recent weeks for your man crush Koji Miyoshi, Sam, which I'm sure is disappointing you no end. But Postecoglou set his team out with basically Ogihara and Akita at the base of the midfield, and then he's just let Marcos Junior, Nakagawa, Edgar Junior, and Keita Endo just run around and do whatever they please. So Miyoshi has found a starting spot hard to come by. Basically, I think since he came back from the under-22s earlier on in the season, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's pretty disappointing for me, but at least I'll see him in the Copa America, so that'll be all right. But I think I can't argue with Postecoglou's decision. With having Keita and Ogihara in that midfield, it's a bit more of a solid base, where as Miyoshi is always going to go forward, so was Amano. So he took both of those players out, and it's worked really well for him. Got Marcos Junior into that central position, so he can link up better with Edgar Junior and then Nakagawa on the other side. So I can't argue with the decision. I think it's worked well. But Miyoshi as well, he's come off the bench in a number of games. He's got goals as well. So it's not like he's just put his head in the sand after being dropped. He's kind of taken on the challenge. And hopefully he can then work his way back into the team, do well on international duty for Japan. I think it's just going to be a good learning curve for him. And I'm sure he'll come back stronger.
All right, Sam, let me come straight back to you before we leave this game, because as Ryan said, there's a lot of people listening to the podcast who are interested in Yokohama S Marinos, and people from Australia listening who have started following the team because of the Ange Postecoglou link. So let me ask you about this three-game winning streak that Yokohama are on, and whether this might be a turning point. It's not the first time they've won three straight games in the league under Postecoglou. They did it for the first time last season in match days 27, 28 and 29. So just when we thought they were ending the season on a positive note, on the back of those three wins in a row, they then proceeded to win just one of their last five games of the season, indeed losing four of the last five to end the season on a rather flat note. So now that they've won three games on the spin again, is this the start of something? Is this finally the moment when Postecoglou's F Marinos are going to click? I mean, they could hardly be in a better position. They've had some tremendous wins this season and some terrific performances, but they've also laid a couple of huge eggs, but they find themselves third in the table, and yes, a goal difference behind their prefectural rivals, Kawasaki. So from this sort of a base, 14 games into the season, are we seeing the possibility of a breakout for Postecoglou's F Marinos? How far can they go this season? I think I asked almost an identical question to Alan Gibson last week, but now that they've got that third straight win under their belt, and he's got 2 weeks to work with them again, it looks to me like the sky's the limit. Which way do you look at it?
I mean, just before you answer, Sam, just keep in mind how your predictions usually go.
Yeah, terribly. I was looking not to bring that one up, and we won't know that I picked Urawa to win the league, but we'll move on. they've got a very good base, and they've always threatened, as you said, to kind of break out, but then there's always the defeats. Like, they did win the last three games, but the game before, they lost 3-0 to Cerezo Osaka. And Cerezo had not found three goals before all season and never looked like doing it. So you can never really tell. There's always a defensive lapse in Yokohama. But going forward, they're very, very good. Probably the best team in the league, just in an attacking sense. The last three games, they've beaten a Kobe team that are in disarray, a pretty terrible Jubilo team, and then they've won this game. It was a difficult fixture in a derby, but it was also a Shonan team without probably six key players. They were out without the back line that started the league season through suspensions and injuries and such reasons. So it's difficult to just lay anything based on these three performances. I think let's see how they do when they come back after this international break. They've got a game against Shimizu, which could end 7-7, any score line, those two defenses put together. But then they've got Matsumoto, should be another very winnable game. Then it's the game against Tokyo. If they can come away with another three victories, then definitely Yokohama are a team that could go on and compete for the league. But they have to keep this consistency. Three wins in a row is great, but can they convert that into fives and sixes? And that sort of consistency has been lacking under Postecoglou so far under his time at Yokohama. So, yeah, reserve judgment at the moment. They've definitely got the quality in that team, but I don't know if their consistency is quite there just yet.
All right. Well, that's very well said. What do you think, Ryan? From what you've seen of F. Marinos, three straight wins. But as Sam said, the quality of the opposition is a question. But they can only beat what's in front of them. But that search for consistency has been going on for a season and almost a half now. So, I don't know, do you see that F. Marinos might have possibly turned a corner here?
I think Sam's absolutely right when he says that consistency will be the main thing that they really need to find going forward. So I think we do need to wait a few more games before we can really say anything like, you know, use the words title contender, because I think it is still too early to say. They need to be really beating, I suppose, could you say stronger opponents? Could you just say more in-form opponents? It's a hard definition to really make, but they need to be not just scoring goals, but they need to be not conceding as many. Against Shonan, they conceded, I suppose, a fairly, I wouldn't say easy goal, but it was definitely not one that they would be like, oh, okay, yeah, we'll give them that. Those are the sorts of goals where they need to not allow the opponent to capitalize on mistakes. They need to not be punished like that. They really need to be able to respond a lot better to those sorts of moments. And that's where the consistency is going to come in. And that's what's lacking at the moment. So they really need to work on that back half of the team still. It was a much bigger problem last season. You know, this season they've really turned a corner in that respect. But just getting those two ends to gel a bit better will make things look a lot more positive, I suppose, for them.
Yeah, all right then. So before we ended our chat on FC Tokyo and Oita, we wondered whether Trinita's bubble might have burst or be at least creaking at the seams. I guess we're going to have to start asking the same questions about Nagoya, Sam, because in the last three games, they've matched Oita's results, a draw and now two consecutive defeats, the latest of which came away at then-bottom club Vegalta Sendai on Saturday afternoon. But Sendai rose from the foot of the table and up to 16th with a 3-1 home victory. It looks obviously quite convincing, but when you watch the game and when you go through the highlights, then there was a huge chance for Nagoya, for Mateus at 1-1. His acrobatic shot was saved, and then Sendai scored two goals in quick succession by Shun Nagasawa, a quick fire brace from the big man up front to ultimately win it for their hosts Vegalta. That was after Kaina Yoshio scored in just the sixth minute for Vegalta, and then Mateus scored one of his long range belters just before the half hour. So. I typed out Sam, no Joe, no party for Nagoya, as they've lost a back-to-back games while their Brazilian striker has not featured. But that chance at 1-1 Mateus, I mean, he did very well to get his leaping volley on target, but it wasn't to be. And yes, Sendai ultimately claimed what has turned out to be a massive 3 points for them.
Yeah, it's a great result for Vegalta, first and foremost. Helped in no short measure by Mitch Langerak having perhaps his worst ever performance, at least in the J-League.
Yeah, as an Australian, I didn't want to mention that, but yeah, that third goal was an absolute embarrassment for Langerak, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid I can't let him get away with it. Even for the second goal, he bushes it straight out into the six-yard box for Shun Nagasawa, and those are the only sorts of goals he can score. So it was just, yeah, so he just had a shocker. I think they're definitely missing Joe up front. I mean, they played Hasegawa and Mateus. Neither of them are really strikers, and you lose that focal point. They can't really build their attacks in the same manner that they are able to usually, because Joe is so good at holding the ball up. And then they also dropped Gabriel Xavier, which is always confusing whenever that happens, because I think he's probably their best player alongside Schmidt in midfield. So I think that sort of creativity was missing, the focal point was missing, and yeah, it just didn't kind of work as well as it usually does. It was the same against Matsumoto last week, where they had all the possession in the world, but just didn't really create enough good chances. In this game, they had a few good chances, but without the quality necessarily, or just the ability to finish those chances. And then you can't really legislate for goalkeeping errors at the back, which have cost them dearly in this game.
Yes, indeed. So, Nagoya, well, I mean, they're still fourth in the table, but as I said earlier, level on points with Kashima and Oita now, and now 9 points off top spot. It was a horror show for Mitch Langerak, especially on the last two goals. And Grampus will hope to have Joe back fit and firing after the international break. And, I hope to have his partner in crime, Gabriel Xavier, back in the starting lineup as well. As Sam said, it was curious to see him start Saturday's game on the bench. All right, so before we leave, Grampus, Ryan, have you seen much of them this season? And what did you make of Saturday? Because it was another disappointing performance, and that's three in a row from them now.
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of the scoring of from Nagoya, I kind of feel like every other game there's a goal from outside the box from Mateus, because maybe it's just the 2-0 win against Urawa that's still fresh in my mind, but it just feels like he's their main point of attack, and it's those kinds of goals that get them their wins. But going on to the goals that they concede against Vegalta, I think some credit needs to be given to Vegalta for being really proactive on those loose balls, on the second balls, actually making the runs and not hesitating to make the runs to get to those balls first. But also the body language of the defense of Nagoya was just absolutely atrocious. There's no doubt that the third goal for sure was a fault of Langerak. I mean, there was nobody really available for him. You could see what he was trying to do. He was trying to play out to the first defender on his left. That option wasn't available. And when there's no option available and they're not making themselves available, you've just got to play forward. You've just got to put the ball out there and just get them to start again. But for all three goals, you could just see that the defense had just completely switched off. The first goal, Langerak kind of hesitated a little bit. Maybe if he didn't hesitate, he would have been able to get to the ball and cover that shot a bit better. But you can see, Schmidt in that goal, he's just kind of walking. He's not really paying attention. The second goal, they're all just ball watching when the ball goes loose. The ball goes loose and they're all just kind of like, oh, we'll just see what happens, instead of being really proactive. There's only so much that Langerak can do, because it was in a weird position trying to palm it out. Admittedly, he did palm it out into the path of two Vegalta players, so it was inevitable that they were going to get a shot when the defense is like that. So you could maybe argue he's to some fault there, but I would also be blasting the defense as much as possible in that game, because that was some of the worst defending we've seen in the league, and I'm an Urawa fan.
Rightio. All right then, so we'll leave Grampus there and move on to the two 1-0 victories from the match day. Sapporo jumped back above Hiroshima in the table after beating Sanfrecce at the Sapporo Dome. Indeed, these teams have swapped spots in the table. So Sapporo finished the match day in seventh, and Hiroshima dropped a spot back to eighth. Ryota Hayasaka scored just past the hour mark. Notable, this game was notable for the long-awaited return of Jay Bothroyd. Jay, friend of the podcast, of course, started on the bench and then came on for Musashi Suzuki in the 71st minute. But Sapporo had to play the last 3 minutes and then stoppage time with 10 men after Lucas Fernandez was sent off for a second yellow card in the 87th minute. But Sapporo were able to see out a 1-0 home win. And then down in Tosu, Cerezo Osaka won 1-0 again, and for the second straight match, it was Bruno Mendes with the winner after fresh off beating table toppers FC Tokyo at home last week. Cerezo went down to Kyushu, and they had so much fun last week. They doubled their fun this week. Mendes is scoring in the 39th minute, and that's four wins in their last five now for Cerezo, as Tosu's three-game winning streak is halted, and they slipped from 14th in the table back down to 17th. And if you're interested, if you're someone who's still interested in Fernando Torres, well, yeah, nothing to see here, as he was not involved in the match day squad on Saturday. So, Sam, was there indeed anything of note to see from these two games? I didn't see a massive amount from the highlights, but maybe you picked out a nugget or two.
Well, it's difficult to pick anything really out of the Cerezo game, first and foremost. I mean, it was always looked like a game where the first goal was going to be the winner. There wasn't a lot of creativity on either side. Cerezo have kind of built in the last few weeks just to be kind of resolute and defence first. They've kept a lot of clean sheets. I think three of the last four league games they've kept a clean sheet in. They've been really difficult to beat. They've taken out the likes of Souza from midfield and Desabato, brought in kind of a bit more workman-like midfields like Fujita, and it's kind of worked for them. They've got a few goals out of Bruno Mendes as well, and Tosu kind of didn't really have a lot. They've gone back to their playing with Toyota up front and kind of working to their strengths, which it's done well for them for the last couple of games. But he went off injured right at the start of the second half, and then, as you said, Fernando Torres was nowhere to be seen, so that really left them short of numbers in the attack. Kanazaki got very isolated up there, and there was no real route to way back into the game for Tosu after that. And then on to Sapporo, another game really with a lack of creativity. It was good to see Jay Bothroyd back, but Chanatit missed out just behind the striker with, I think it was a thigh injury. He's pulled out of Thailand international duty as well. And then with him and Anderson Lopez both out, there was very little behind the striker for Sapporo. So they did very well to kind of grind out a victory and put in a very good defensive display, which isn't something you usually see from a Misha Petrovic side. And it was quite surprising really to see how subdued Hiroshima were coming off the back of that big victory over Reds last week. We saw nothing like the kind of energy that they had in that game, and it was a very poor performance from them. So they're kind of stuck in that higher mid-table position, and I think any sign that they were going to be in like a ACL push as they were at the start of this season, I think that's kind of diminishing a little bit as we move on throughout the season.
Yeah, Ryan, I don't know how you felt watching this Sapporo Hiroshima game after seeing your side get absolutely battered by Sanfrecce last week. Then they headed up to the Sapporo Dome and looked like a completely different team. Looked like the Hiroshima that we'd seen for most of their losing streak before they suddenly snapped that at your place last week.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they walked away from that win thinking, oh, this is going to be too easy, and then you know they get a slap in the face from reality, really, because I don't know where this side was last week, because would have really appreciated it. But I mean the game itself, I don't think there's, with all respect to both teams and the supporters of both teams, I don't think there's a great deal to really talk about. The red card from that, I can't even remember what it was for, to be honest. I went back and looked at the highlights, and there was no replay of the red card. They showed it happen, but I would have to go back and probably look in slow motion to see. I don't know if you can fill me in properly on what actually happened with that one.
As far as I can tell, there was a second yellow card, but as you say, I didn't really see what the second booking was for. I don't know if it was just an off-the-ball incident, but yeah, I'm not really sure what was going on there.
Yeah, it's just baffling. I mean, I thought maybe they would try to explain in the highlights, try to justify it for the sake of the referee, but it's just, I suppose, one for the eternal mysteries of J-League refereeing, I suppose.
All right, then. Well, so that leaves us with three games left to cover, and they all finished 1-1, but all were noteworthy for different reasons, I would suggest. At the Suita City Stadium, Gamba Osaka drew 1-1 at home with the Kashima Antlers, who we've mentioned a couple of times, currently sit fifth in the table, level on points with Nagoya and Oita, though where Antlers had to come from behind here after Ryotaro Meshino netted for Gamba in just the 13th minute, and that came after he had already had a shot saved at the keeper's near post, a fierce blast, and Meshino's goal, an absolute first-time screamer into the top corner from inside the D, was absolutely tremendous. And this young attacker is certainly grabbing some headlines. He's one to watch. Most definitely, I guess, Gumba supporters with recent history in mind better enjoy him while he's there, or he might be joining the likes of Usami, Dorwan, etc., out the door pretty sharpish. But as I said, Antlers had to come from behind, and they did with a typically classy finish from Sean Madoy 2 minutes before half time. I tell you what, guys, we'll do all three games, and then I'll let you discuss what you like from them as a group of games. So we'll also talk about Matsumoto 1, Shimizu 1. This featured some fairly comedic refereeing, I would suggest, and I'd be interested to get your opinions on my hypothesis there. Both goals came from the penalty spot, and we'll work our way through, and I'll make my feelings known about the referee, Mr. Hajime Matsuo, who has a previous, of course, in the J-League. Matsumoto took the lead from the spot in the 67th minute after Leandro Pereira was admittedly upended by Mitsunari Musaka, but Musaka took a decent chunk of the ball in his challenge, and so I think the referee obviously made his decision and then wasn't unable to change it. He probably wishes he would have been able to do so, and he clearly made amends to S-Pulse about 12 minutes from time, because Douglas's comedic dive was rewarded. He had already started falling to the floor when he made contact himself with the Matsumoto keeper, Tatsuya Morita, but Mr. Matsuo bought it, as I say, clearly to make amends for his first wrong decision, and Douglas slotted the spot kick, as I say, with 12 minutes to go, and it finished 1-1. And the third game of the match day that finished at 1-1 was at the Ikopa Stadium in rural Shizuoka. It was Iwata hosting Kobe, an early goal and a late goal here. Kobe went ahead from the spot after Hirotaka Mita was upended, and David Vija scored from the spot in the third minute. Then right at the death in the second half stoppage time, the Kobe defender Dankler was sent off for a deliberate handball. He basically punched the ball off the line to deny Iwata a certain goal, and a no doubter of a red card that. The Kobe keeper saved Rodriguez's penalty, but so Dankler's decision to do a Luis Suarez almost paid off. But, Rodriguez was able to volley in the rebound, and the points were shared. So that was quite a mouthful. So where else should we work our way through these? Sam, anything to take away from the Gamba-Kashima game, apart from the quality of the goals from Meshino and Doi?
Well, they were very good goals. Meshino's made a rod for his own back with two absolute belters to start his J-League career. going to see him try and keep that up. Yeah, it could be going the way of those other players that you mentioned going off to Europe, which would be another blow for Gamba, because they've had to kind of reset this season. Like, they've always wanted to kind of get rid, not get rid of, but move away from the likes of Endo and Connell, who have been kind of stalwarts in that midfield, but they'd always hoped that players would come through, like an Idiguchi, for example, who would have been perfect in that midfield, but they lose those players quite early, so they've never really been able to replace them. Last season, Leviakulpi tried to bring in the youngsters, but they weren't ready at that point, and it really didn't work. But now, kind of, Miyamoto has been forced into playing the younger players in there, like Leo Takai and Shinji Ajima have come into that midfield, and it's been a breath of fresh air, really, for Gamba, especially helping out defensively. When the likes of Endo and Connor can't cover the amount of ground that they're used to, and they were leaving that defence really open. So by having the younger players, maybe they're not quite at the same technical level as Endo and Connor, but the work rate they put in, the ground they cover, and the extra help they give has really helped Gamba and kind of sorted out that defence. I know they conceded one in this game and there were a couple of other chances, but in general, Gamba have been a lot more solid in the last couple of games. Maybe it's taken away from their attacking prowess. They haven't really scored too many, but yeah, I think it's definitely an improvement for Gamba, and they look to have kind of settled into this season. As for Kashima, I think they're really a little bit average in this game. I think they're still waiting for the likes of Yuma Suzuki to come back. I think he's aiming for a return either straight away after the international break or maybe towards the end of June, and that's going to be a real boost for them, and I think they should be able to push on at the end of this season in the same way that they sort of did at the end of last season. So I think a late run from Kashima into that top three is what I expect to happen as the season progresses.
Yeah, with Antlers, Ryan, I guess it's kind of similar situation to one of your most recent appearances on the podcast, where we were talking about Reds, obviously, but we kind of noted that Reds were not that far away from the top three, and indeed not even that far away from top spot at whatever point of the season that was, without playing particularly well. I mean, since then, I don't need to remind you, results have gone horribly, and Reds are closer to the bottom of the table even than the top three. But I mean, as Sam says there, I mean, Antlers have find themselves in a similar situation now, where they haven't hit many heights this season, I would argue, and indeed they haven't had their main man up front, Yuma Suzuki, for any of their games so far. But yes, they find themselves a level on points with the fourth place Nagoya, 3 points off second. So for a team with their pedigree, I mean, you know, we were saying last week how disappointing their loss was, and I mean, they would have expected to win this game on Saturday. But yeah, the way they sit and the sort of team they are, then nobody's sort of writing them off about at least qualifying for the ACL again. And a title push is certainly not beyond them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you only need to look at the table to see, they've got a decent goal difference. Actually, it's better than Yokohama F. Marinos in third place. They've scored a decent chunk of goals, and they've conceded less than a goal per game on average. So it's not. I would definitely not say it's doom and gloom for Kashima at all. They're well within striking distance of the top three. Kawasaki and Yokohama are only a win between them, essentially. It's definitely theirs for the taking if they want it. They obviously would, but the real challenge is making sure that they can bounce back from a slight blip. But it's a very, very slight blip, really, in terms of performance. Yeah, they've still got a decent. They're not far off from their run of wins that they just had. So, I don't think there's any spilt milk to be crying over at this point.
All right. And from the other two games, I mean, basically all four goals were scored from the penalty spot or a rebound from a penalty, Sam. So the Matsumoto Shimizu game. I've obviously said my piece there about the referee, Mr. Matsuo. Did you have any differing opinion on the merits of those two penalty decisions?
Yeah, I agreed with you. I thought Musaka got his foot on the ball for the Matsumoto penalty. I thought Douglas went down very early for his penalty. But you've got to think, like, the defender diving in the way he does, he gives the referee a decision to make, and it's always risky when you do that. And even with the goalkeeper against Douglas, he's flying out there as well. Douglas sees him, and then he kind of buckles his legs and falls to the floor. So some would argue it's kind of clever play from Douglas, although it looked a bit obvious to me, but the referee bought it. But you run the risk when you kind of dive in like that. And then even the penalty in the first penalty in the Vissel Kobe game, in the build-up, Wellington's clearly offside, and that's not called up by the official. So then they play on from that, and then they get the penalty. So that's three penalties that I don't think should be given, but less arguments about the fourth one. But I think Dankler had to do that in that situation, similar to Luis Suarez, as you said. He almost won his team 2 points. So I can't argue with him for that. I think it was the right decision, but in the end, he's gone and his team have conceded.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention that Wellington offside, Sam, because I thought if I did, then some eagle-eyed listener might pick me up on the point that Takefusa Kubo was offside in the build-up to FC Tokyo's first goal. So, yeah, I kept my mouth shut there, but you've made that point, and I agree with you.
I'll be entirely honest with you, Ben. I was going to bring that up as well.
Yeah, well, the rub of the green, I guess, Ryan. Yes, a linesman slightly out of position worked in Tokyo's favour on that occasion. So, yeah, I'll certainly take it. Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting, Ryan, how Kobe get on in their next league game, because they will play without the much maligned Dankler, who has been an ever-present in recent months, and he's come under fire from basically all sides. A lot of people on Twitter, and indeed guests on this podcast, certainly do not rate him, although some have said that his performances have turned around in the last few match days. But now, obviously, he's going to be suspended after his straight red card. And as Sam said, he almost won his side 2 points at the death by literally taking one for the team. So we'll wait and see. From a distance, yeah, what have you made of the Kobe clown show in recent weeks? Of course, they were coming off a victory that snapped a long run of losses, and they were obviously seconds away from making it two straight wins. So we will never know whether they might have actually been starting to turn a corner, but yeah, I mean, following a team that obviously gets as much attention as Reds does, and then seeing Kobe making all these splashy signings, and I mean, no, I'm not trying to suggest you might be jealous of the attention they're getting, but I mean, they're obviously becoming a big story themselves, a manufactured Galacticos, if you like. So, I mean, what have you made? I mean, you might have been chuckling all the way through as they've been losing all these games. I mean, the way the Mikitani's empire seems to be crumbling around him.
Well, I mean, we can put it this way, that for a lot of the games that Vissel play, they've been playing without at least one of their main foreigners, one or two of their main foreigners. So, you know, are they really going to miss Dunkler? Because that's just another of the same thing, really. The whole experiment, I don't think anyone that is even remotely cynical thought that this was going to be much more than it's really been. I think only the people with the most bright-eyed, bushy-tailed optimism would have thought otherwise, because I don't think it's really been, none of it's really been a match for the J League. You know, they brought in a coach. They've had a merry-go-round of coaches. Essentially, it's just a revolving door. Because there was a graphic to go on a very slight tangent. There was a graphic that showed the Rakuten takeover of Vissel Kobe, and they've had something like 16 coaches in that time, 16 managerial changes. It's absolutely ridiculous to think in really such a short time, or within, you know, a handful of seasons at a time, there's several managerial changes throughout a couple of seasons. So the instability has always been there, and I don't think that bringing in star players was ever going to help that. From a marketing perspective, it's been absolutely phenomenal. You know, there's attention all around the world on Vissel Kobe. They're essentially the new unnamed Chinese club of world football in terms of having big names linked to them. So it's definitely done wonders for them in that respect, and Rakuten are a good global brand with the amount of sponsorships that they have through even different sports as well. So all of this has really helped them in some way. And as long as they survive the drop, I don't think that they're going to be too upset at this stage. The only thing will be that their fans will be a bit embarrassed, because there was all the, you know, the whole club motto is, isn't it, that they want to be the best in Asia within the next few years or something like that?
That is indeed their slogan, this year's slogan. Yes, the number one club in Asia. And we've discussed that with a number of guests so far this season, how ridiculous that is. But well, I tell you what, you mentioned they'll be happy if they stay up, Ryan, and that segues me on to basically my final question to the pair of you. I'm not obviously asking you to decide 14 games into the season who you think is going to get relegated, but the situation at the bottom is it's simply fascinating, isn't it? With five teams now joint bottom. That five teams have 13 points after 14 games. They are Iwata, Gunma Osaka, Sendai, Tosu, and Shimizu. They all have 13 points, and they're, Iwata are the best of them on goal difference. S-Pulse, by far the worst in terms of, goals conceded. They're absolutely miles the worst, but Tosu's very anemic goals for column means their goal difference is almost as bad as S-Pulse's. So, I don't know, guys. So basically, we find the table looking quite J2-ish, I would suggest. We don't have too many separations throughout the table. I mean, obviously, Tokyo leading by 6 points is the biggest gap of any teams in the table. Then we have a three-point gap between F. Marinos in third, and those three clubs we've mentioned numerous times on 24 points. Then basically Sapporo are the halfway point of the league in seventh place. They're 10 points off top, and they're 10 points off bottom on 23. All the way down the table from there, there's a three-point gap to Hiroshima and Cerezo Osaka. And then, I don't know, Ryan, do you feel you're going to be in a relegation battle this season? Because you're 5 points off the bottom. And with so much traffic down there, you're probably not really looking over your shoulder at 10th place in the table. But, I mean, the points tally doesn't lie, does it? I mean, it's so bunched up down there.
Yeah, well, I mean, as that losing streak kept adding up, and you know, you start looking at the bottom, and you start thinking, you know, who can knock you off? Because Jubilo got points, got a win even against Urawa, so it's not that far fetched to think that anyone can knock them further down the table. In terms of, you know, who can survive and who can stay up and or go down, There's a couple that you look at and you think, you know, definitely, like as you mentioned, Sagan Tosu, they have an over reliance on doing their best to not concede as many as possible. They're the I suppose almost the reverse Shimizu, really. Shimizu on the other hand have conceded, I think, almost double the amount of goals, but they've scored almost three times the amount of goals, or yeah, almost three times the amount of goals as Sagan Tosu have. So those two, I think, you know, and unless they have a drastic turnaround, I think they're almost cemented into relegation, or at least you know, the bottom three, if not an automatic relegation spot. So it's such a dire situation for those two that I think the others that are on joint 13 points. they're almost kind of, you know, wiping the sweat off their brow, you know, in relief that saying kind of under their breath, well, at least we're not those two.
Indeed. And Sam, we'll finish here. I'd like to reiterate that I'm not looking for predictions, so you don't have to worry about that. But yeah, in a relegation battle, you know, we wonder what sort of things might make some sort of a difference, might prove to be a hindrance to one of the teams looking to work their way out of relegation danger. And I mean, yeah, simply the fact that Tosu have scored 6 goals from 14 games, and even though they're 3 points away from that logjam of 5 clubs on 13 points, Matsumoto have scored just 8 goals from 14 games. And if those two don't buck up their ideas in the summer and start scoring slightly more regularly, then any prospects that they would have of hanging around, or of, you know, at least securing their J1 status with some comfort towards the end of the season, looks unlikely to me.
Yeah, that's what I'd look at, really, the goal-scoring ability in these teams. And I'd throw Jubilo in that mix as well. I don't think you can rely on them to get goals. At least with Shimizu, they have players like Hitagawa and Douglas especially, who can possibly fire them out. But then there's a transfer window coming up in the next couple of months. If I was a J1 team in the upper half, I'd be looking to try and take Douglas away from Shimizu. I think he's a really good player, and I think if they lost him, then I don't think there's much hope for S-Pulse. But as it stands, they're a team that can score goals. They're trying to sort out the defence. I wouldn't say it's been sorted at all, but I think if they can sort of try and deal with that at the back, they've got enough goals to kind of make a push out. But it's really difficult to separate a lot of these teams. Like, from the bottom half, only Sagan Tosu didn't get a point over the weekend, and that's a team coming off the back of a 3-game winning streak. So you really have no idea what sort of team is going to turn up in each day. No one could have predicted, really, Vegalta Sendai beating Nagoya 3-1 after they lost to Shimizu S-Pulse the week before. So, yeah, it's, as you mentioned, it's like a J2 season. No one, I don't have a clue what's going on. I'm not sure if anyone has much of a clue what's going on at the bottom, but it's going to be fascinating throughout the rest of the season.
Most heavenly. And now we have a 2-week break, as I said, to stare at the league table. And obviously for me as an FC Tokyo supporter, it makes a lovely viewing. Yes, we're 6 points clear, and I'm still pinching myself. So yes, that's whether or not we lose at Takefusa Kubo in this international break. Hopefully we'll get some clarity, and the club will actually let us know what's going on. But not really holding my breath at the moment. But obviously Kubo is away training with the national team at the moment, ahead of Kitten Challenge Cup friendlies against those international heavyweights, Trinidad and Tobago and El Salvador. Those are games coming up in the next week or so. So we'll, as we usually do during an international break, I'm sure we'll be back to chat about them in some sort of detail next week. Of course, we usually do international breaks with no J1 games. We usually have a J2 special episode of the J-Talk podcast, but we are launching our new J2-centered podcast named J-Talk Extra Time. And again, thanks to our Patreon subscribers for their excellent choice in naming the new podcast. And as I said at the start of the episode, the first episode of that will be dropping hopefully on Wednesday afternoon if all goes to plan. So J-Talk podcast J2 specials are now a thing of the past. We're moving forward with J-Talk Extra Time, and really excited to see where Stuart and John will take their own venture. Should be absolutely fantastic to listen to. So, for now, I guess we'll leave it there, guys. J1 Match Day 14 was certainly eventful, and the build-up to it was as well for Ryan as an Urawa supporter, of course, with a lot going on behind the scenes. So for now, I will let you both go. So firstly, Ryan, great to have you back on the show and to get your thoughts about all things J1, not only Reds on this occasion. So take it easy, mate, and I'll speak to you again soon, hopefully.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. And again, congratulations on J-League Extra Time. Congratulations to both you and Stuart and John, and also all the patrons that contributed on Patreon as well. And I'm sure you'd agree that they played the biggest part in making all that happen.
Most definitely, yes. We literally could not have done it without them. So, yes, their support is very much appreciated. And, yeah, thank you for saying that, Ryan. And, yes, yeah, Sam, always great to catch up with you. Yeah, so much happening in J1. And as we've said towards the end there, we've got no idea what's going on. But that makes it all the more fascinating, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much for having me. I echo what Ryan says, and I'm very much looking forward to the debut podcast from Stuart and John tomorrow.
Yes, well, it's sure to be fascinating, those two together. Goodness knows in which direction they'll travel, but yeah, it's sure to be fascinating listening. And yes, thanks as well to Sam for your kind words there. All right, then, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. My thanks again to Sam Robson and Ryan Steele, and of course, to you for listening wherever you are. We'll be back next week to chat about the Japan friendlies, and by then we might have some clarity on Takefusa Kubo's future as well. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk Podcast.